I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. When you think of refugees fleeing civil war and violence, chances are you picture overloaded boats with desperate people hoping to make their way to Europe, or women and children at the U.S.-Mexico border having made a dangerous trek through Central America hoping to find a haven in the north. The two refugees in Mohsin Hamid's new novel, Exit West, Nadia and Syed, are in love. And they are escaping their perilous and chaotic city through a mysterious black door, a portal to a safe and unfamiliar place and an uncertain future. They first land in the Greek island of Mykonos, then go through a door to London and one to Marin, California. Hamid explores the pain of leaving home and the sense of loss and dislocation for these two refugees. He writes, "When we migrate, we murder from our lives those we left behind." Hamid has also said he's felt like a migrant his whole life. Mohsin Hamid was born in Lahore, Pakistan, lived for some time in California, in Boston, New York, and London, and now lives in Lahore with his family. Joins us on Radio Times. Nice to have you back with us on the show.
Thank you.
You know, when I started reading this, and I thought of C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and then I started reading reviews of your book, and people said it's rather like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, this idea of this portal, this doorway into another world. Were you thinking in any way about C.S. Lewis?
I probably wasn't thinking of C.S. Lewis specifically, but that book had a big impact on me. When I moved back from California to Pakistan at the age of 9, I was at that point a Californian kid. I'd forgotten how to speak Urdu. Pakistan was a totally foreign country for me. And I began reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe at that time, and it's a story of these children who go through this door into this magical place called Narnia. And I felt like I had just done something quite similar.
Yeah.
And so it had a big impact on me, and I'm sure that it was sitting in my subconscious somewhere.
But of course, in Narnia, these are middle-class British children. In your book, this portal is a place that desperate refugees can escape through.
Yes. Well, I think to a certain extent, these portals kind of exist in our world today.
Really?
So when you open your phone or you open your computer and you look at your screen and you're Skyping with somebody, what is that? Yes, it's technology behaving in a particular way, but it's like looking through a window. And when you're surfing the internet and you're reading about an Israeli kibbutz or an Antarctic research station, your consciousness is gone there. And I was in Pakistan just a few days ago and then stepped through a door, wound up in London and Dublin, New York, and now I'm in Philadelphia. Modern life is like a series of doors.
This story starts in a city that you do not name. And I remember when you were on the show the last time talking about your book, the Filthy Rich book, also didn't use names. Is that because you want the reader to, in a sense, identify with the story, identify with the characters?
Yeah, partly it was just to open up some space for it. I used the city of Lahore, where I live, as my template for how the city starts. But what happens to it is much more like what's happened to Aleppo or Mosul or a city like that. And a week and a half ago, we had the Lahore Literary Festival. An American artist was there, Molly Crabapple. And she'd been spending a bunch of time in Syria, and she'd just read the book. And she told me that she felt it was set in Aleppo. And I said, I've never been there. But that's, I guess, part of what I'd like to do. I'd like it to be open. And another part of it, though, is I didn't have the heart, really, to do to Lahore fictionally what I do to that city. The city really goes into a terrible situation. It would have
rather like Aleppo, I would say.
Yeah, and I think in Lahore, I hope that won't happen. I don't think it'll happen. But because it's not so completely beyond the realm of possibility, I just didn't want to write it.
But are you also saying that kind of all big cities are the same around the world?
It's incredible how similar they're becoming. So I remember coming to Philadelphia back in 1989. My college roommate was from the Philadelphia area. And we popped in, and it struck me as so different from Lahore. You know, this big city, this giant river, big bridges, tall buildings. It was a completely different way of urban living than Lahore. But if you come to Lahore today, Lahore also has tall buildings, radio stations, art galleries, you know, lots of things that are not so different from Philadelphia. And big cities, I think, are converging. They're becoming more similar. Sometimes the gap between an American big city and an Asian big city is quite small.
And so many people around the world flooding to cities.
I mean,
this kind of dislocation is worldwide.
Well, it is the Great Migration. So in America, you had it decades ago. People left the countryside as farming got mechanized, there weren't enough jobs in the countryside, they moved to the cities. And Philadelphia and New York and all became huge cities. That's happening in Asia and Africa now. Billions of people are moving to the cities, and they're becoming vast, these cities. Some cities are as big as entire American states in terms of their population.
In fact, you have said, you described yourself as a migrant, but I also read that you said, in a sense, we're all migrants. Even if we kind of stay put, we are still migrants.
Absolutely. One thing which happens to every human being is that we migrate through time. You know, we're all refugees from our childhood. If you think of the school you went to, you know, the people who played in that playground have dispersed all over the world. The playground itself has been paved over and made into a cement parking lot. The school has been replaced by a shopping mall. As time goes by, the city has changed. New people have moved in. Your neighbors have moved away. The feel, the languages around you. So there are people who are 70 or 80 years old in Philadelphia who've never lived anywhere else who will still feel like they've migrated an incredible distance.
I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of your book, but perhaps tell us a little bit about Nadia and Saeed.
So Nadia and Saeed are two young people who live in the city, and he works in advertising, she works for an insurance company, she has a motorcycle, he has a small car he shares with his parents, they're on their phones a lot, they use social media and messaging
to
each
other. What does this sound familiar? But yeah, keep going.
Yeah, and you know, they meet and they start to fall for each other. And they're having, in a way, an urban romance that could be in so many places. But then their city starts to go through some terrible circumstances.
Well, let's have that reading from the very beginning of your book.
In a city swollen by refugees but still mostly at peace, or at least not yet openly at war, a young man met a young woman in a classroom and did not speak to her for many days. His name was Saeed and her name was Nadia, and he had a beard, not a full beard, more a studiously maintained stubble. And she was always clad from the tips of her toes to the bottom of her jugular notch in a flowing black robe. Back then, people continued to enjoy the luxury of wearing more or less what they wanted to wear, clothing and hair-wise, within certain bounds, of course. And so these choices meant something. It might seem odd that in cities teetering at the edge of the abyss, young people still go to class, in this case an evening class on corporate identity and product branding. But that is the way of things, with cities as with life. For one moment we are pottering about our errands as usual, and the next we are dying. And our eternally impending ending does not put a stop to our transient beginnings and middles until the instant when it does. Saeed noticed that Nadia had a beauty mark on her neck, a tawny oval that sometimes, rarely but not never, moved with her pulse.
What? There's so many things in this book that I found just fascinating, including this couple, including Nadia. And there are things you cannot say on the radio. But one of the reasons that she covers herself, and one would assume, okay, she's very religious, and that's why she's doing that. Nothing could be further from the truth. She's pretty much an atheist or a-religious?
Well, you know, as far as we can tell, she has no religious practice or interest really in religious practice.
But she wears this essentially to protect herself from men.
Yeah, well, in a way, Nadia is someone who doesn't want other people looking at her, how they see her, to define who she is. She is somebody who sort of wants to walk her own path. And in the city where she lives, for a woman to be living on her own, away from her family, unmarried, is to invite all kinds of unwelcome attention and to be potentially dangerous. So she dresses in a particular way. But in some senses, she's like, if you go to college and you have a friend who's come to college with you, and that friend suddenly changes their clothes and hangs out with different people and speaks in a different way and becomes a different person because they were being seen by people back home, and the way people back home used to see them made them into something else. And now they want to be what they want to be. And that's what Nadia is like.
I always think it's so interesting that, you know, what is under all the, what do people wear under the things that they have covered themselves up with?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, I've seen a friend of my wife's has become a very famous television actress in Pakistan. And everywhere she goes, she's being recognized. So she will often wear the most conservative sort of outer garment, which makes it impossible to know who she is.
Right.
But she could be going to a party where she's wearing underneath, you know, the kind of things you might wear to a party in Philadelphia if the weather was warm. And all kinds of things get worn underneath. It's amazing how the outer garment doesn't tell you too much about what is underneath.
If people think that Pakistan is about, and it is in part about Malala Yousafzai being shot as a young girl wanting an education, your book also tells a very different story. This is a young couple in love. They use hallucinogens. They try to figure out about sex. Nadia's mother seems to really like, as a young woman, she enjoyed having sex. It's another picture of Pakistan that I think people, if they even think about Pakistan, don't even know about.
Well,
no, or can't even imagine.
Well, people are people. That's the interesting thing, is that, you know, we imagine that people in Pakistan or people in America are just, you know, one thing or the other. They're not. People in Philadelphia are different from people in Utah. And people in Philadelphia are different from other people in Philadelphia. And similarly, you know, Pakistan is 200 million people. So one has to imagine that somewhere along the line, someone enjoyed sex a fair bit. But I think for Nadia and for her mother, but particularly for Nadia, she's a strong, independent woman.
Yes, she
is. And the world is full of people like that. My family, my mother is one of seven sisters, two brothers and seven sisters. And so I grew up, in a way, raised by a tribe of strong, independent women. One of my aunts was the first pathologist, female pathologist in Pakistan, was a trailblazer in medicine. And when I was a kid, my dad was a grad student and my mom used to work. And so, you know, he'd be at home making me peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and she would come home, you know, from the commute in the evening. And so we needn't expect that in a place like Pakistan, there's some kind of rigid, stereotypical gender system. It does exist in part. You know, women's rights in Pakistan as a whole are much less, you know, protected than the United States. But Pakistan has twice elected a female prime minister, and the U.S. has yet to do the same.
But do you, as a novelist, do you want to offer a kind of a corrective through this story?
Well, this novel, the city is unnamed, so it's not really meant to represent, in a sense, Pakistan. But the corrective I'm trying to offer isn't to say, hey, think that Pakistan is like this or think that Muslim-majority countries are like that, but rather think that people are people. You know, let's focus on these two characters who are Nadia and Saeed, and what do they do? How do they behave? What are their attitudes towards sex or religion or life, romance? And I think once we start looking at people, a lot of these presuppositions start falling away, and I think that's the more powerful corrective.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Mossad Hamid joining us on Radio Times, talking about his new novel. It's called Exit West. And he was last on Radio Times talking about a previous novel, Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. Was that the title? How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. You can join our conversation. Call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more to talk about. Also some more readings as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Mohsin Hamid about his new book. It's called Exit West. It's about two young refugees who flee their city that is being torn apart by conflict and violence and civil war. And again, you can join the conversation if you want to send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. I have to say, and I guess because the images of Aleppo are just so frightening and so horrifying, we begin to see this couple and this unnamed city where they live is beginning to fall apart. You get little hints in the beginning something bad is coming. But next thing they know, or over time, they realize that they're really in the middle of a war zone.
Yeah, it happens gradually. So in Lahore, where I live, there are maybe some of the, over the last 7 years I've been there, there have been little hints of the beginning of that. There'll be a suicide bombing in the market, and then for a week the restaurants will be pretty empty, and some people won't send their kids to school, and things will be quiet. And then it sort of comes back to life, or there'll be some big threat of an attack, and cell phone service will be turned off for a day. But then it comes back. But in this city, it gets worse. Lahore, fortunately, has had some very terrible incidents, but has stayed more or less resilient. their city begins to crumble. Mm-hmm. The incidents get worse and worse, and they start seeing their modern urban life, one that so many people will have lived similar versions of, become something much more particular and unsettling.
And more personal in a way. I mean, when you begin to realize either you're losing friends or you could lose your own life because of this.
Yes. They're going through it with the violence increasing, but it remains kind of abstract. You know, you might hear a bomb or you might see something, but it doesn't touch you. And then one of Nadia's cousins is killed in a truck bomb. Yeah. And she goes to the grave and say it accompanies her. And that's the first time it touches them. And that changes things because it's not some abstract phenomenon.
I'd love to have you read another section from your book there to our listeners, filled with Post-its. Go ahead.
Refugees had occupied many of the open places in the city, pitching tents in the green belts between roads, erecting lean-tos next to the boundary walls of houses, sleeping rough on sidewalks and in the margins of streets. Some seemed to be trying to recreate the rhythms of a normal life, as though it were completely natural to be residing, a family of four, under a sheet of plastic propped up with branches and a few chipped bricks. Others stared out at the city with what looked like anger, or surprise, or supplication, or envy. Others didn't move at all, stunned maybe, or resting, possibly dying. Say that Nadia had to be careful when making turns not to run over an outstretched arm or leg. As she nosed her motorcycle home, followed by Said on his scooter, Nadia did have several moments of questioning whether she had done the right thing, but she didn't change her mind. There were two checkpoints on their way, one manned by police and another, newer one, manned by soldiers. The police didn't bother with them. The soldiers stopped everyone. They made Nadia remove her helmet, perhaps thinking she might be a man disguised as a woman. But when they saw this was not the case, they waved her through.
Again, kind of this slow evolution into some kind of dangerous city, a dangerous place to be.
Yes. I mean, these symbols you see happen in different ways in different places. You know, in London, for example, now you do see more armed police on the streets. And I remember after the attacks of 7/7, there was much more of that. The airport security got much more. And the same thing in the United States. You know, if you see the TSA security environment of a contemporary American airport and you compare it to what American airports were like in 1989 when I first came here, it does feel like America has moved into a different era. And in a sense, it has. So these things happen slowly. But what has happened to London or Philadelphia over the course of some decades happens to, say, the Nadia city in the course of some weeks.
Yeah. You describe being in a city like Lahore where you live, where something will happen, people get scared, they change their life, and then that slowly life returns to the way it was. In this book, there's a whole interesting section about all of a sudden windows that let in light and where you can put plants and all sorts of things, let in fresh air. Windows become something different, something dangerous.
Yes. An architect friend of mine in Lahore tells me that if windows were invented today, glass windows, nobody would allow them to be used in buildings because they're so potentially dangerous. We've been using them for thousands of years.
Yes, we have.
But when a blast goes off, windows shatter and that glass flies and people can be very badly injured by the glass. Some of the worst injuries at a long distance are from the glass. And so a friend of mine, there was a bomb blast not far from his house, and his wife was at home sleeping. And she was woken by the blast, but lying down, and the window, the glass flew over the bed and hit the wall and sort of fell on her. It didn't cut her particularly, only very mildly. But she thought, if I'd been standing, you know, what would have happened? And so, yes, the thing that you use to look out at the world suddenly becomes the way for the world to come in and potentially get you.
So do you look at windows differently?
A little bit.
Now that you describe.
You know, a little bit. I mean, I'll give you an example of this. About a week and a half ago in Lahore, after a year that was mostly peaceful, when we were thinking things are getting much better and we're coming out of this very dark place, and I still hope that we are, there was an explosion in Lahore, and people said, oh, get your kids from school. So I went and picked up my kids from school, brought them home. Mm. And then this rumor started flying around that more explosions would go off. And it happened to be our neighborhood that they were talking about. And so my kids were playing in the bedroom. And, you know, I remember lowering the curtains and saying, hey, why don't you guys come play over here a little bit further away? And certainly in the back of my mind was something about the windows.
Of course, parents, that's a situation I think that parents around the world have to think about, especially in war zones. And again, going back to Aleppo, and you see people that still live there now, which I've always, what keeps them there? And in certain ways, your book is about that.
Well, absolutely. And the one thing I'd say is we don't have to go as far afield from Aleppo. There are children who are growing up in America in neighborhoods where their parents are frightened of them going out on the street.
I would say parts of Philadelphia that way.
Absolutely. So it's happening everywhere. Now, as parents, one thing that we realize is that, you know, we sort of depend on the benevolence of the entire society around us to bring our kids home safe every day. And when that idea that society is basically benevolent starts to go away, you know, when people don't care about protecting kids or actively target kids, for a parent in particular, it's like a shocking change on how the world works.
Yes. For Nadia and Syed, they decide to leave their city. What's the precipitating factor?
It happens slowly, and it has to happen slowly in a way. You know, so often we say that, oh, migrants or refugees, they're coming for better economic opportunity, as though they've sacrificed nothing or it was an easy decision. But the decision that, say, the Nadia have to make, you know, say, we'll never see his father again. They will be dispersed. All their groups of friends will never hang out again. The food that they're used to, the music they're used to, the places around them they've grown up with will be gone. Mm-hmm. And it is a kind of death to leave in that way. And I think for people to undergo that, to decide to do that, there's a huge amount of sorrow that first takes place. And in their case, it's the growing violence. Sayed's mother is affected by it, and their work
she's
is affected
killed.
By it. Yeah, she's killed by it. And just in passing, randomly. And so Sayed's father recognizes that he can't go with them, that if he goes with them, he'll be a burden. And so he makes a decision, which is to say, you know, son, you have to go and I'm going to stay. And many parents make this decision. You know, imagine how difficult it is for your children to want to leave where you are and for you not to say, don't go, stay with me. Because, of course, that's what you want more than anything. And to reach that point where you think, look, my love for my child can best express itself in telling my child not to look back, that's a terrible position to be in.
At one point, Syed says to his father, you know, you can go because your wife is dead. I mean, there's sort of nothing here. And he says, but she's not dead to me. I mean,
yeah.
Which frankly broke my heart to read that.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, when somebody, you know, leaves the world and they die, they pass on, we retain an emotional connection to them that is built on so many different things. You know, the house that we shared, the places we went to, the restaurant we had our first date in, their grave. And that can be a very powerful force. And Sayed's father doesn't want to, in a sense, leave his wife, even though she's no more. And that's also part of why he stays.
It's either you or Nadia says going through these doors, this portal, is both like giving birth but also dying. And,
yes.
And I think that sort of encapsulates what you were talking about, how it must feel to leave a home, even if it feels completely unsafe.
Well, a migration has these two components of birth and death. There's a death, which is the life that was before. That life sort of dies. Yes, you can go back and visit people and speak on the phone, but it's not the same thing. It's a sort of ghostly existence. And it's also a birth because you arrive in a new place and you begin anew. And so there is the trauma of that. And there's also the potential of that.
Yeah.
And so as their old lives die away and they're reborn into these new worlds that, say, the Nadia go into, in part they also react differently because Nadia has her whole life sort of been looking forward to being reborn. And Sayed can never stop thinking about the life he had before.
Yeah. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Mohsin Hamid, and we are talking about his new book. It's a novel called Exit West, and it has to do with refugees and migration and leaving home. And you can join our conversation. You can call our comment line. You can also text us 267-405-2006. Sounds awful like the world that we are living in, even though this is fiction. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. you know, what sometimes things get published, but they've written a couple of years ahead. Were you looking into your crystal ball and imagining today's world as you were writing this?
Well, I wasn't imagining the specifics. I handed my novel in a couple months before Britain voted to leave the EU. And if you'd asked me, I would have said, oh, that's not going to happen. And I was telling my friends that, you know, Donald Trump will never become the president of the United States. So I was clearly wrong about a lot of things. But the underlying trend that people were becoming afraid of the future and depressed and wanting to look back, and that we had sort of nostalgic political visions, you know, make Britain like it used to be, make America great again the way it used to be, you know, restore the caliphate, the Islamic caliphate, and make things the way they used to be. These nostalgic political visions I did see getting stronger and stronger. And so I wanted to write a book that actually looked in the future, didn't look back, and explored a kind of optimism as an antidote to this nostalgia.
In fact, I wasn't sure as I was talking to you before going on the air. I said, you know, I came away from this book feeling optimistic. And yet, you know, we've spent half an hour talking about the difficulties that Nadia and Syed have had to deal with being refugees.
Well, optimism is really important. You know, one thing which difficult political environments create for so many people is a sense of like depression and pessimism. But we can't really move forward unless we start to articulate something we can be optimistic about. And that's one of the things that fiction does, that literature does. You know, literature is a society, a culture, humanity, imagining something that's different from what used to be and what is. And in that sense, literature can be a profoundly optimistic act. And I think politics also needs to be a profoundly optimistic act, particularly in these circumstances.
You have described yourself as a migrant. You also told an interviewer, LitHub, people are going to move in vast numbers in the coming decades and centuries. Sea levels will rise, weather patterns will change, and billions will move. We need to figure out how to build a vision for this coming reality that isn't a disaster, that's humane and even inspiring. And I have to say, to hear some degree of optimism in today's world is a novel experience.
Well, you know, look back 50 years ago. If we were having this conversation in 1967 and we were in America, and people
exactly.
said, what's the future going to look like? People would have said, well, you know, we'll be flying in flying cars and people will be equal and there'll be so much prosperity. It's going to be great. Today, we find it so difficult to articulate a future that we want to live in. And that's a dangerous position for any society to be in and for humanity to be in. And I think part of the problem is that we are clinging to a notion that things won't change. Things have to change. Things will always change. 500 years ago, there were no people of European ancestry living in America. Look at America today. 500 years in the future, America will be as different from America today as America today is from the time before Columbus. That's how time works. And so it's very important to accept transience, you know, the idea that things pass and that that's, in fact, beautiful. That's the human condition. At the moment, we're so engaged in not letting things pass and to holding on that we are paralyzed. And so I think that is a historical moment quite different from America's recent history. And I think looking back in 20 or 30 years, when I imagine a much more optimistic future will reassert itself, we'll think of this moment of pessimism as a point of change.
Do you think nostalgia is based on fear?
Yeah, nostalgia is based on fear, and it's also based on the fact that we've lost many of our antidotes to nostalgia. So it used to be that we had things like stories and folk culture, and those have dissipated. We used to have religion as a way of sort of spiritually answering this pain. But now religion has very often become a way of sort of who's in and who's out of my group. It's become political. We used to have families that protected us, and now families are dispersed by, you know, travel and economic suffering. And so we've lost all of these old ways we had to not be terrified of change and of the future. And we haven't yet invented the new things we need to help us navigate this. And that's why I suspect the fear that we're feeling is worse than usual, because the antidotes have stopped, you know, working. It's as though, you know, we used to have these antibiotics that used to fight fear. Fear has evolved around them, And we need a new set of antibiotics.
Do you think this angst is global? I think it's certainly felt here in this country, probably in your country as well.
Yeah. I mean, you know, think about ISIS or Al-Qaeda, these kinds of things. You know, what are they about, really? They're not really about fighting the West as such. They are about fighting the westernization of people who live in Muslim-majority countries. It's a mistake to think, oh, you know, they hate our freedom. I think that's a mistake. The real thing that scares people is, what about these kids in Pakistan and Iraq who are, you know, getting strange piercings and tattoos and living in weird ways and doing all this funny stuff? If we can provoke a fight between Western countries and countries in the East, maybe we can stop this process. So it's actually very similar to what you have over here, except there it's not a fear of migrants coming. It's a fear of migrated values coming.
About a minute before our break here, and I don't like to boil things down to one word, but I often think at the root of all this is sex.
Well, sex is a big part of it. You know,
whether it's piercings or however sex is expressed.
Because sex is the way that things mingle and new things, hybrids are created. Sex is the way that two impurities come together and make something new. And our fear of impurity is tied up with our thoughts about sex.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, you can join us, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can also call or text our comment line, and that's 267-405-2006. There you go, sex on the brain. 267-405-2006. And we're talking with Mohsen Hamid about his new book covering a whole host of things, including sex, but also including refugees and the complicated world that we are living in. So I do hope that you will stay with us, join the conversation. We've got more to talk about and another reading as well. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, Mohsen Hamid is our guest. His new novel is called Exit West. It imagines refugees escaping through a magical passageway to a safer but unfamiliar place. The book is about why people leave home, what is left behind when faced with violence and unrest and an uncertain future. His previous books include The Reluctant Fundamentalist and How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. I'd love to have you read another section from the book. And our two refugees go from Mykonos to London and now imagine going to America.
Yes. And so when she suggested one day, out of the blue, under the drone-crossed sky and in the invisible network of surveillance that radiated out from their phones, recording and capturing and logging everything, that they abandoned this place and give up their position on the housing list, and all they had built there, and passed through a nearby door she had heard of, to the new city of Marin, on the Pacific Ocean, close to San Francisco. He did not argue, or even resist, as she thought he might, and instead he said yes, and both of them were filled with hope, hope that they would be able to rekindle their relationship, to reconnect with their relationship, as it had been not long ago, and to elude, through a distance spanning a third of the globe, what it seemed in danger of becoming.
Does America still hold out some kind of hope for refugees?
Yes. I mean, I think this particular moment is a bit frightening. It's sad, in fact, that, you know, in a way, if you think about refugees, the reason why all over the world refugees have a protected status is the same reason why when there's somebody drowning in a swimming pool, it's customary to try to help them in some way. If you can't swim, you throw in a life preserver. If you can swim, you jump in. You call a lifeguard. Because the sight of human beings in that condition evokes in all of us the idea that, you know, we have a duty. Refugees are like that. These are people who are living in really terrible situations. And it might be slightly risky to help them. It might be slightly uncomfortable. But surely our shared humanity is more important and more powerful than that.
You wrote a pretty powerful piece in Time magazine in the fall. You described, you know, runaway slaves from the South coming to Boston, Jews fleeing the Third Reich coming to this country, saying we would never imagine sending these people back to where they came from. I mean, that's really unimaginable and, as you say, un-American. And then you say, why such an outcry over accepting refugees from places like Syria? And then you go on to say our currently potent answer appears to be that it's because these refugees are Muslim and Muslims kill Americans, so they must not be let in. But Americans kill Americans, too. Indeed, they do so at more than four times the rate at which British kill the British, the Indonesians kill the Indonesians, and the Chinese kill the Chinese. An American's chance of being killed by a terrorist is vanishingly small. That is all true. And yet somehow there's something about the other, the Muslims coming to our country that frightens people.
Yeah, well, it's a useful fear. I think, you know, I live in Pakistan, and the risk of terrorism in the city of Lahore, where I live, is higher than it is in most American cities, any American city, really. The most potent response that we have to terrorism is courage. You know, if we are unwilling to take any risks in our lives, we never leave our house. You know, you wouldn't drive a car. A life where you take no risks is not a life worth living. The real, I think, choice is, how can we live a life that we think is decent and interesting and fulfilling, and we accept the risks that come with that? So I think, you know, focusing on the tiny, tiny risk of terrorism and making it into something that terrifies us into behaving in indecent ways is to lose to the terrorists, actually. Courage, which America was founded on.
Home of the brave, as
yes,
you say in this
absolutely.
Article.
I mean, imagine if the pioneers had said, you know what, it's pretty risky out there in the West. I think I'll stay in London. You know, I don't want to go and deal with there's no police and there's no ambulance service and, you know, I might get sick and I could get hurt. Surely America has not been built on the idea that we reduce risks at all costs. If you want to be free, you have to take a certain degree of risk. And it's a bit funny to be saying this from Pakistan, you know, where I live, but I see many people going about their lives managing their fear. And I think it's very important in America that politicians and people communicate not just that, of course, we have to have adequate anti-terrorism responses, but that as citizens, it is your duty to try to be brave.
As you say, life isn't perfectly safe. We're all going to die eventually. I mean, do you think Americans are fraidy cats?
I think something's very strange has happened. That somehow Americans have been made so afraid of this. You know, your chance of being shot by someone who's not a terrorist is so much more. Your chance of dying from, you know, your diet or your smoking are so much more. But this one fear that a terrorist is going to get you is like the fear of a great white shark eating you up. I mean, what would you do if yes, there are great white sharks off the coast of California. Will you never surf or swim in that ocean? It is a terrible impoverishment of life to live in that way.
Were you worried about coming to the U.S. on your book tour?
Yeah, and it's interesting to say. Again, it shows you how, you know, fears can be unfounded in a certain extent. I was, you know, thinking, my goodness, what will happen to me at JFK Airport? You know, I'll be kept. I could be searched. I had my editor came in and was waiting outside, and I had, you know, all this documentation and pictures of me on the covers of magazines. And my daughter was saying, Baba, don't go, don't go. She's 7 years old. She was afraid for me. I was out of JFK in 15 minutes, you know,
that tell you? What does that tell us?
You know, it tells you there's a degree of randomness to things as well. There's a lot of arbitrary power, I think, that people who are in immigration or also police type positions can have. A decent person can behave very decently with that arbitrary power, but somebody who chooses to abuse that power or to be unpleasant for the sake of being unpleasant can. And so I wouldn't say I was wrong to be nervous, but I came anyway. And I actually didn't have an unpleasant experience. I had a very pleasant experience at the airport.
Does your 7-year-old daughter talk about Donald Trump? Has that infiltrated into children's lives?
It's so strange because it has.
Pakistan,
as a 7-year-old child, she is unaware of really any political figure outside of Pakistan except for one. And that's, actually two. Hillary Clinton is the other one. But Donald Trump is one that the kids in school are terrified of. They think that, you know, they've heard that he hates Muslims and he doesn't want us to come to America. And She was in New York. We all spent a month in August of last year. And after we left, she said, Bob, I want to move to New York. I love New York. America's my favorite place in the whole world. And now she's saying, please don't go. You know, who knows what's going to happen to you? And, you know, these sorts of statements, you know, one particular group of people, in this case Muslims, are different from other groups of people and, you know, more worthy of being stopped or not allowed in. When they're made by the president of the most powerful country in the world, are terrifying. You know, if you think about, you know, what is terrorism, for example, frightening people all over the world is, of course, not the same as killing people, but is also quite a terrible act. And I think, you know, communicating with decency and not scaring the 7-year-old school children of planet Earth is something that one would hope the U.S. president would do.
Are you saying the president is not a terrorist, but that he is using terroristic language?
Well, what I'm saying is that the president is frightening people. And I think there's something very different from that in saying he's a terrorist, but he's certainly frightening people. This kind of rhetoric frightens people. And why frighten these people? The truth is that, you know, America's greatest allies against intolerance and bigotry are living in countries like Pakistan. You know, I have very close friends who risk their lives to protect the rights of Christian minorities in Pakistan. You know, Muslim people who are actively engaged at considerable personal risk. Are these people the enemy? You know, how can they be the enemy? It's an mm-hmm. absurd position.
Let me play a call we got from Dave. He called into our comment line.
My name's Dave. I'm calling from Mount Airy. Your guest is very thoughtful, and I would just be interested in, is he optimistic about the future of humanity? Where does he see the global culture in the next 50 years?
Dave, thanks for calling into our comment line. Your thoughts?
Well, I think it's inevitable, given how technology is working, that stuff is going to mash together in new ways. And we're going to see new kinds of hybridized cultural things express themselves, you know, not just Eminem, a white rapper, but all kinds of crazy things, you know, women in hijab on catwalks, you know, American workers in Pakistan, you know, there'll be all sorts of strange new combinations. And that seems, in a way, quite frightening. Oh, my goodness, you know, this will be this new strange thing. But remember this, a century or two ago, what was American culture didn't exist. American culture today is a mashup of people from all over Europe and other places coming together and creating new stuff. And that's what you live in today. So this new hybridized, mongrelized, mixed up future that's coming in some ways seems very frightening, but in some ways it's actually very American.
You grew up, you were born in Lahore. You live there now, and describe yourself as a migrant, having lived in other cities as well. How about your family? Does your family kind of represent this migrated world that we live in?
Well, they're all different types. And I think, you know, I have family members who never want to leave Lahore and have never left Lahore. I have family members who are deeply religious. I have family members who have traveled all over the world and live in different places and aren't religious at all. I have a large family, you know, a dozen aunts and uncles, 30 cousins, and they're all kinds of different people in that group, as there are everywhere. I can understand, for example, in cities in America, where towns in America, where the jobs have gone away and people are still there, and you say, why don't you leave? You know, I have cousins who maybe are in very similar circumstances and haven't left, and they haven't left for good reason. They love their friends and their families and the people around them. That's a very good reason to stay put. But in a sense, the way of making life better for people like that isn't to demonize other people, but to create an environment where they can flourish where they are. And that's a very different program, I think, than saying, you know, let's try to demonize, you know, Mexicans or Muslims or foreigners.
I'm thinking about Nadia and Syed, about just what happens to those memories. I mean, the farther and farther you get away from your home country, your home city, those memories become vaguer, harder to remember whether they're true or not.
Yes. Your memory does start to get away from you, and you begin to imagine what your childhood was like and imagine things in the past. You know, just in the same way you imagine a relationship. Ah, our love affair was so beautiful. I should go back. And you meet again and you start talking. You realize, I know why we broke up. This is, you know, not what I imagined at all. So I think that's, in a sense, what happens to Nadia and Said as well. They begin to imagine their past differently.
There's also, I mean, when they're in these refugee camps and they're moving from one place to the other, they have so much time on their hands. It makes you think about when you live with someone, how busy you are with the things that you do, even if it's the laundry or whatever. But they don't have any of that. They,
yeah.
In a sense, they have nothing to do.
Yes.
Besides,
well,
survive, of course.
Many of us will have experienced this. You know, you meet someone the last week of a summer holiday and they've come from far away and you're just together for a week and you throw yourselves into the romance and you didn't hold anything back and it's, I love you and this and that, because the universe is pulling you apart. But when the universe smashes you together into a tiny tent in a refugee camp or a small apartment in Philadelphia and you see each other every single day, all the time, then it's the opposite instinct, which is to say, look, I want to hold back. You know, I don't want to be so closely enmeshed. The Arab poet, writer, Khalil Gibran says that, you know, we should drink of each other's cup, but not the same cup. You know, that each
great.
Of us should live our own lives and thereby remain interesting. If we try living one shared life, we become boring to each other.
A tweet from Holly saying, this is the most enlightening and uplifting conversation about immigration that I've ever heard, which is nice. Thank you, Holly, for saying that. Also a tweet from Pete. He says, the people in fear are not in the cities. I would beg to differ. There are parts of this city where it is dangerous for children to play outside or for people to go to the corner store, or kids to go to school. So there is danger in cities and danger, of course, in other parts of the world as well.
Absolutely. I think, you know, one thing which is clear is that just like there are parts of Pakistan that are quite a bit like America, there are parts of America that are quite a bit like Pakistan. There are places where children, as you say, are, you know, it's dangerous for kids to play outside. And in that sense, instead of imagining that we live in these different worlds, it's far more useful to imagine that we actually live in a shared world. Yeah. And lessons from one place can be helpful someplace else.
You went to Harvard Law School. I remember asking you about that the last time you were on the program. Do you think being a lawyer helps you as a novelist?
Weirdly enough, yes.
Really?
If you'd asked me that 20 years ago when I was at Harvard Law School, I would have said, I'm not sure I made the best of decisions. But 20 years later, thinking back to it, I actually was just there. I gave a talk there yesterday, and it was a beautiful sort of full circle in life, 20 years later, speaking at this place where I had listened to so many talks. The interesting thing about the law is made up of words. Words really matter in the law. And like the American Constitution is a dream of what could be. You know, it's saying, let's imagine a country like this. And in that sense, there's something not entirely dissimilar between making a novel and some aspects of the law and thinking about words as powerful and words as, you know, a direction for the future. I think the law and fiction are potentially cousins.
Well, on that note, Mohsen Hammed, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times. We've been talking about his new novel called Exit West, and you can catch up with our guest. He's speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program. In fact, we took some pictures of our guests, which we have posted as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Aarons, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.